You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis, and onto the bus we go.
Line 180, Hollywood, flying station.
Federal law, all passengers must wear a face mask.
If you're taking that Metro bus in Los Angeles, don't forget your tap card and some cash. LA Metro resumed fare collection this week after nearly 2 years of free bus rides. The passengers have been allowed to board without payment since March of 2020 as a COVID precaution to allow people to enter at the back to keep riders a safe distance from drivers and from one another. But to the disappointment of riders and public transit advocates, LA Metro says it just can't afford to do that anymore. And joining us to talk about this are three people whose work is rooted in the buses and trains of LA. Jacob Wasserman researches public transit and shared mobility at UCLA. Channing Martinez is the director of organizing at the Bus Riders Union, which represents the predominantly low-income African-American, Latino, and Asian mass transit ridership of LA County. And Jessica Meany is the executive director at Investing in Place, which provides budgetary strategy for Metro and the city of LA. And I want to thank you all for being with us right now.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
All right, Jessica, I'm going to start with you. LA Metro declined to join us, by the way, for this interview, but in a statement they said that the reason they're restarting fare collection is because that money helps keep the system running. Does that seem reasonable to you? We have these buses. When you ride these buses, we need money to keep the buses going.
Right. No, it does not seem reasonable to me. I understand Metro has been saying that message for several months now, but they are an agency with an $8 billion budget. There is certainly funding to pay for fare-free transit in Los Angeles County. Predominantly, we all contribute to how our transportation system is funded, from our freeways to the sidewalks, to the roads, to the bike lanes, to the buses, to the trains, through our sales tax. So every time we get some food to go or buying something, we're paying into our transportation system. So our buses aren't necessarily reliant on that $1.75. And in fact, we have a pretty low fare box ratio, they call it, the money that comes in from passengers paying fares and what it takes to run. It's an outdated way of thinking about how our transportation systems run, that you gotta pay for your buses.
As I mentioned, letting the riders on buses for free was a COVID precaution, and it allowed people to enter through the rear. Are you surprised that Metro is reinstating fares now that we're experiencing? I mean, here we are with the Omicron variant of COVID, and things are just skyrocketing. Does it seem less safe to you that drivers and riders are having to deal with this now?
It certainly doesn't make a whole lot of sense, given the numbers Los Angeles County is seeing and the importance of buses to many of our communities. I would say this whole move to reinstate fares and to eliminate all-door boarding is part of a larger systemic issue at Metro, really just on the quality of our bus service and the way Metro leadership is really failing all of us.
Channing, speaking of vulnerabilities, I want to turn to you. And, you know, the Bus Riders Union argues that collecting bus fares isn't just unsafe because of COVID, but that it endangers people of color regardless of the pandemic. How so?
Well, here you have a pandemic of multiple sorts, right? And you have the COVID-19 pandemic, but you also have the economic pandemic that stems way before COVID-19, where mainly Black and Latinx bus riders are just simply not making enough money to afford the bus fares. Meanwhile, they are paying sales taxes, they are paying their taxes to actually pay for the bus service. And so it's an endangerment because Metro is basically driving people to desperation, and from desperation stems violence, right?
You've gone so far as to say that collecting and enforcing fares actually violates the Civil Rights Act. Explain that.
Yeah, so when you are collecting fares and you've done so for several years, and year upon year upon year, the statistics are the same in that Black people are 50% or more of the tickets, then by collecting fares or re-implementing fares in this source, you're admitting that you know the statistics and you're going to continue criminalizing Black folks that cannot afford the fares. So it then is a violation of civil rights. The other thing to say about it, oftentimes the fare evasion citation is just an excuse to then criminalize people for other situations, right? So one of the other metrics of criminalization that's happening on the buses, for example, is that Black people are also receiving 55% of the tickets for either taking up an extra seat or putting their feet on a seat. You know, what I liken that to is during COVID-19, there's a lot of folks that are on the buses that are saying, please do not sit next to me. I'm trying to social distance, according to the federal government. Well, Black people on the buses and trains are actually getting ticketed for social distancing and ticketed at alarming rates.
There's been a lot of discussion about riders feeling unsafe and whether there should be more or less of a police presence on the transit system. And, you know, I know Metro Channing is also looking at a plan to replace some law enforcement with so-called transit ambassadors. So what does the bus riders union have to say on that issue? I mean, would that solve part of that problem, transit ambassadors?
I think it would. And in fact, when you look at the metrics, we've seen the assaults on bus drivers go down tremendously. And that's because most assaults and most interactions with bus drivers is around the fares. And folks are in a moment of desperation and they cannot afford the fare. And no matter what they do, they're trying to make ends meet. And when they get on the bus, the bus driver, unfortunately, gets the backlash of all of the frustration that's going on in their lives. And so because the fares have been free, most of those assaults have gone down, actually. So we think that the idea of the transit ambassadors, or what we call conductors, is a great idea. We don't need police on Metro buses and trains. And the more the buses and the more social services in this city are subsidized, the more that people can take care of themselves, the more the numbers for crime, quote unquote, will go down because people are not in their mode of desperation trying to just figure out how to survive.
Jacob Wasserman, what has ridership been like during the pandemic? I mean, you just heard, you know, we're trying to social distance in this pandemic that spreads very quickly. Is it getting back to pre-pandemic levels, or is it still a lot lower than it has been because of the fear?
Yeah, the points before are spot on. I'd say transit ridership in LA has reversed itself with in comparison to ridership in the rest of the country. In the 5 years before the pandemic, ridership in LA declined almost a quarter, worse than a lot of other cities in the country and a lot of other parts of California. But during the pandemic, Los Angeles ridership was actually much higher. Because our system is largely ridden by essential workers, low-income riders, and riders of color who often rely on transit to get around because they don't have access to a car or some other mode of transit. And so ridership right now, I think it's between 60% and 80%, depending on the agency and the time of day, of what it was before the pandemic. But that's much more of a recovery than we've seen elsewhere. And ridership is highest in low-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color across Los Angeles right now.
Do you think Metro will ever get rid of the bus fares?
I think there's a path to it. Fares make up about 15 to 20% of Metro's operating funds each year, which is not nothing, but is also a sum that they could make up through other sources of revenue, potentially congestion pricing, which I know that the Metro board was looking at as a source for fare-free transit, sales taxes, or some other revenue source to help fund it, because it's something that can be funded if Metro thinks outside of the box and looks at ways to make transit, you know, really accessible for all.
Jessica Meany, to help ease the transition, Metro's offering these half-price passes for the first 6 months of the year, I think, and larger discounts for low-income passengers. They've also implemented a program where K-12 and community college students can ride for free as well. Would you say that's a step in the right direction? Is that helping in this transit? I mean, obviously, it's better than nothing, right?
Is it helping? I appreciate the effort. And also, some of our colleagues, Move LA, others who have been advocating for free student transit for a long time. It's wonderful. But you know, Steve, the devil is in the details. How many people are actually aware of these reduced passes, have access to them? That's always where it seems to fall down. I really challenge some of the way Metro gets the word out and actually works with community groups so people are aware. Previously, there's been a wild unsubscription, like a wild under enrollment in LAUSD transit passes. So I'm hopeful, but I'm also skeptical. And also, I think Channing has raised this before. So the life passes, you need to prove you're under a certain threshold of, I think it's 40,000 for a family of two, I think it is, a year. But Metro puts out all these facts about who rides the buses, and they're all predominantly under 25,000, under 20,000 a year in family income. So if we know that the majority of Metro's transit ridership is qualifying for these reduced passes, why are we making people apply and figure out how to go online and upload a picture of their ID? Like, it seems like mixed messages. If you want to have commitment to serve our vulnerable low-income populations who rely on the bus, which is a pretty crummy service right now, why are we continuing to throw up barriers and prove you're worthy of a reduced pass? So I appreciate the sentiment to work with our schools, and I think that's a wonderful idea. But I'd love to see the details on what the outreach looks like, the enrollment numbers look like, and also question if all of those target audiences are already riding the bus and predominantly make up the ridership, what is this, an exercise in bureaucracy?
Jessica, we should obviously talk about bus drivers as well. You say a labor shortage is one of the biggest factors in why there's such bad bus service in LA. Why is this bus driver shortage happening? And how does it affect the way people move around the city?
Yeah, so if you go out and try to catch a Metro bus these days, and you know about this app called Transit App, I use it, you can put where you are, see when your bus is going to come. If you do that, right now you're frequently seeing strike-throughs on certain, say the bus is supposed to come at 8:15, there's a strike-through on it. What that means is that bus has been canceled because there's no one to drive it. Some of our most important, heaviest routes in Central Los Angeles and South Los Angeles are being canceled, run after run after run, because there's no driver to run the bus. This has been an ongoing problem since the pandemic started, where families need to stay home, operators need to stay home to take care of their families, childcare issues, getting COVID themselves, all sorts of things. And regrettably, Metro has been very slow to respond to this shortage, and it keeps getting worse and worse. It's on par with the Great Resignation across the country, where we're seeing nobody really wants to drive a Metro bus for $17.75 an hour at part-time hours. That's just not a competitive job offer for a lot of people. And as a result, buses are more unreliable than they've ever been, more crowded than they've ever been. And I think it really, for me, it's like, when is Los Angeles going to get serious about our buses?
Jacob Wasserman, how does this conversation that we're having today surrounding bus fares relate to the bigger conversation surrounding, transit, transportation, congestion in LA? I mean, is Metro doing a good enough job making sure that everybody's covered? Is the city doing a good enough job? I mean, the Olympics are coming in, what, 6 years?
Yeah, there's been a lot of money and energy at all levels of government surrounding the Olympics and surrounding the expansion of rail transit. And some of that does have the potential to allow neighborhoods and parts of the city like the Valley to be connected to downtown and the West Side. But the bulk of riders in Los Angeles are taking the bus system, and that is really not been prioritized, giving buses their own lanes to move more people more quickly through LA traffic, implementing congestion pricing strategies with low-income discounts to help make our roadways work the way they were designed to. These are all strategies that are being considered, but have not been implemented yet and are leaving riders stuck in traffic and these days missing runs with all the bus drivers who have called out and service has suffered as a result.
I want to reiterate that we did reach out to Metro. They told us they were short-staffed and unable to offer somebody to interview today. I do want to thank you all for coming on to talk to us. Jacob Wasserman, who researches public transit and shared mobility at UCLA. Jessica Meany, Executive Director at Investing in Place. And Channing Martinez, Director of Organizing for the Bus Riders Union. Thanks to you all for joining us today.
Thanks for this conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. A couple of weeks from today, LA County will send volunteers out into the streets to count the number of unhoused people living in the region. Now, they canceled last year's count due to the pandemic, but the 2020 numbers showed the county's homeless population stood at more than 66,000, about two-thirds just in the city of Los Angeles alone. Theo Henderson has been unhoused. And he hosts a podcast called We the Unhoused, which focuses on advocating for the rights of those folks who are experiencing homelessness. He's just been chosen as a UCLA activist in residence. And Theo is with us right now. Hey there.
Thank you for having me, Steve. I appreciate it.
Isn't it kind of an oxymoron that you've been chosen as an activist in residence when, in fact, you're talking about people who have no residence, right?
Indeed.
You do have a residence. You're recently housed, right?
Yes, recently, yes.
Yeah. Congratulations to you.
It's been a long road. I've been in this place for over 8 years, and it's been very difficult to, especially with the ongoing high rents and things of that nature, to finally find something for it. Maybe, hopefully, that's going to be long-term. It's one of the biggest fears of unhoused people, that they're going to have to return to the streets.
That's the goal, though, right? Getting people in permanent housing.
Absolutely. Permanent supportive housing as well.
Right, because people need help in making sure that they can stay there.
Absolutely.
And I know the UCLA Activist in Residence program is run by the Luskin Institute on Inequality and Democracy, which, according to what it says, it aims to support activists and encourage learning. So learning, activism, things like that, what do you hope to get out of the program?
Most importantly, what I hope to do with my activism and residence is to utilize our future leaders and our future generation of leaders to make the right calls on dealing with the unhoused crisis. Too often than not, people that are leading the conversation have little to no experience in being unhoused. They have repeated the same disastrous solutions and the same harmful narrative, or they listen to the most NIMBYs or business improvement district or neighborhood councils that want to see unhoused people not in sight.
Yeah, sort of out of sight, out of mind, right?
Absolutely. They don't want to see people suffering or learning the effects of capitalism in their doorstep, that some people are winners and some people are not being able to compete at all.
How do you do a podcast? I mean, do you have equipment for it? Do you have a server? You know, I mean, it's certainly easier to broadcast, podcast, you know, disseminate any kind of information you want these days. But how do you do it?
Well, it was a little bit different being from the house perspective. It may have been a lot easier. But from the unhoused perspective, I started my podcast literally with the phone. And I basically marveled at when I would be invited on radio stations and things of that nature, hearing and sound engineers and you know, people calling and getting people to speak on topics. I didn't have that luxury. What I basically did was I had to compose what I wanted, my program, and then I had to sleep into the park or other places. And then I would have to literally do all of the other things, like making sure that the sound was enough that people could hear the quality. I had to wait till the light would go or stop so the cars wouldn't be too loud, or wait till the ambulance would pass or helicopters. Then I had to find the guest list. I basically started off with communicating with my friends that were unhoused and interviewing them. They were very gracious. And you know how many times we had to do takes and retakes, the things of that nature. And then make sure to have the program moving along. And I created Unhoused News because unhoused people's news is very different than housed people's news. We needed to know where the next winter shelter was. We needed to know where if there was a spike in vigilantism or areas to avoid, or if there are neighborhood councils that are harassing unhoused people trying to survive in the rain and things like that. We needed to have that information for our, basically, our safety. So I the whole format was very unhoused specific. I wanted people to learn that the world is not the same for housed people as unhoused people.
Why did you want to do a podcast and not maybe, you know, find another way to get the word out or be more activist at City Hall? Or, you know, there are a number of ways to get involved to really put this front and center, right?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I did try, before I did a podcast, I thought about writing a book to do it. And then I thought about making comics on it. And then as the time, I was always going to City Hall, but they only have short time restraints. And mainstream media, unfortunately, like video media, they want you to encapsulate all of your experiences in 2 to 3 minutes and move on to the commercial break. And they'll talk about rising oil prices and go on, and it's an afterthought. And I believe the unhoused community deserves much more attention and much more nuance and layers to understand if we're going to change the situation, we need to have a very educated outlook on it.
You have some people who listen to your podcast who are in higher places, don't you?
Yes, I was very surprised when I got to find out that City Council member Mike Bonin listens to it. I got to interview him, as well as council member Nithya Raman. I get to interview some of the one of the exciting candidates that's running for city controller, like Kenneth Mejia, People's City Council, who's also running for against Mitchell O'Farrell. Basically, proponents that are really anti-unhoused, and to get their perspectives as well.
You also critique city policy, right, established by the city council, on your podcast. How did that come about?
Funny, because I was mentioning a while ago, like I used to watch the ESPN, how they have SportsCenter, and I'm definitely aging myself, and they had all of these football players, you know, when a game happens, an athlete makes a misstep, or an athlete basically does the right thing, and you have these sports analysts who may be former athletes themselves holding court to talking about, you know, what they did great, what they didn't do great, do they need to be on the team, should they, you know, get rid of the person. And I felt that that was getting the perspectives of people that are directly impacted with it, not some business owner who pretends that they're only their lives matter and not creating a dismantling the system.
You end your podcast, Theo, by thanking people who listen, saying, may we again meet in the light of understanding, which are beautiful words. What do you want folks who listen to this conversation to understand about people who are unhoused, people experiencing homelessness?
When I say meeting in the light of understanding, it's several ways. It's a play on words. When the activist Malcolm X used to say it about enlightening people to a different point of view. And what I say about meeting in the light of understanding is the fact that there's a darkness that has receded over our moral compass as a society as we look at human beings. And we could look at the character of our country is how we look at what we do with people that are vulnerable than us, that basically doesn't do anything for us beneficially, and how we treat them. So when I ask you to look at, we again meet in the light of understanding, I hope you turn on the light in the darker recesses of your mind to understand that how I treat my other human being is how people would treat me. And I want to treat people like I want to be treated. I don't want to be mislabeled. I don't want to be mistreated. And I don't want to be misunderstood.
Theo Henderson, who hosts We the Unhoused podcast and now UCLA activist in residence. Theo, thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having me. Good day to you all.
That's going to do it for us on this Tuesday. We are back tomorrow with another new episode, and COVID testing in LA has turned into a commodity, as you may have found out. Finding a test is pretty tough these days, given the Omicron surge. So what is a concerned person to do? That's tomorrow on GLA. We're also going to be talking about all the potholes in the city and region. Maybe you've experienced one of these. Heavy rains last month made them worse. Some streets actually became impassable. Is the city doing a good job or a good enough job in finding those potholes and fixing them? Let us know your pothole experience. You can do that at kcrw.com/greaterLA. While you're at the website, give a listen to any of our episodes there. Tell us how you're doing. And what are the stories you'd like to hear? Subscribe to the podcast there as well, kcrw.com/GLA, or wherever you get your podcasts. Catherine Barnes, Nihar Patel, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears and time this evening. Have a great night.